So good morning, everyone, and of course, welcome to the Government Services Committee hearing. This morning, we have convened to review the draft bill entitled An Act Representing the Regulation of Real Estate Trading in the Province, a new bill which, if passed by the House, will replace the Real Estate Trading Act. The current act dates back from 1965. The bill we will discuss today is intended to modernize and improve the legislation and regulation of the industry, taking into account modern standards and technology, among other things. The predecessor of this committee in the 48th General Assembly began the review process before the dissolution of the House. We are continuing the work begun by that committee. The last time a bill was referred to a standing committee was in 2002, between 1989 and 2002. A number of bills were reviewed in this way, either in draft form or after second reading. The procedure today will be as follows. The presenter will have an hour and a half to speak, including time for answers, answering questions from the committee. Members will have 10 minutes to speak and may do so as often as they wish. We ask that you identify yourself each time you speak for the benefit of Hansard and the Broadcast Center. And before we start, we invite members and presenters to introduce themselves, and we'll start with the committee.
Yep. Oh, Allison Coffin, St. John's East Kittiviti.
Derek Bennett, MHA Lowsburg Twillingate.
Sarah Studley, MHA from Mount Sio.
Lyle O'Driscoll, MHA Fairland.
Barry Patton, MHA Conception Bay South.
Jamie Chippett, Deputy Minister, Service NL.
Michael Delaney, Assistant Deputy Minister of Regulatory Affairs with ServiceNL.
Renee Dyer, Superintendent of Real Estate.
And I'm Pam Parsons, MHA for Harbor Grace, Portgrave. And now I invite the Deputy Minister of Department of Services, Newfoundland and Labrador, to introduce himself. Sorry, we've done that. And now, Mr. Chippett, if you'd like to start, you can begin your presentation.
So it's okay, Chair. I just have a couple opening remarks before the presentation. I'll be brief. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. As the new Deputy Minister of Service NL, I'm pleased to have this opportunity to speak to this significant piece of legislation, namely the Real Estate Trading Act. I'm equally pleased to have the departmental experts on these matters with me, the ADM for Regulatory Affairs, Michael Delaney, and the Director of Financial Services Regulations, Renee Dyer. The Department of Service NL is the regulator for various professions and services throughout all of Newfoundland and Labrador. We all know that in every region of our province, individuals buy and sell homes every day. We know it can be the largest transaction a person will make in their lifetime. Our goal as a department is to provide advice for the best possible legislative framework in which this transaction takes place to meet the needs of people of the province. We also want to ensure that real estate professionals have the appropriate mechanisms to help them provide a service in which consumers could have the utmost confidence. Just a little bit of background in terms of the process to get to where we are. The current act was proclaimed in 1965, as the chair mentioned, and since that time, no substantial changes were made. In 2012, government engaged with industry on reviewing the act, which reinforced the view current legislation is outdated. And in 2017, ServiceNL launched public consultations and gathered feedback through a number of sources. Staff met with key stakeholder groups to discuss issues of importance and potential changes. Feedback was also gathered by email and online at government's Engage NL portal. 90 submissions were received during that process. I want to acknowledge the contributions of the Newfoundland and Labrador Association of Realtors during this process. NLAR conducted its own meetings throughout the province, and the feedback from these sessions was part of their submission to government. I'd like to thank Bill Sterling specifically and the entire NLAR for their tremendous support and focus on helping bring about improvements in their industry. Through our review of this act, as well as the feedback through the consultation processes, several areas were identified that merit significant amendments, as well as the need to clarify language to ensure it is modern and clear. A very important part of the process was trying to find a balance between the needs of consumers and the needs of those involved in the industry. The amendments cover everything from trust deposits and a recovery fund to personal conflicts of interest and the establishment of personal real estate corporations. These are a few highlights, but there are also additional amendments dealing with orders that can be issued by the superintendent, use of the term broker instead of agent, and clarity to the Act's language. I'd just like to take a minute to thank the minister, the executive, and specifically my predecessor, Sean Dutton, who would have really been involved in all the work on this, and officials of ServiceNL who worked hard to help bring about the changes we are discussing here today, and thank the staff who worked day in and day out in this field. Lastly, I look forward to the discussion with the committee. We appreciate the opportunity and look forward to any questions you may have. So I'll run through the PowerPoint. So we've already started and stated a couple of times that the Real Estate Trading Act was introduced in 1965. There was a review in 2012, including some consultations, but no amendments proceeded at that time. There was a commitment to restart or redo the review in the minister's mandate letter and in the way forward. We've talked about already as well that Newfoundland and Labrador Association of Realtors conducted their own consultations, released what we heard, and provided recommendations to government in their submission after consultations. EngageNL.ca, through EngageNL.ca, survey was conducted, and a what we heard document released. And as I mentioned earlier, there were 90 respondents to that particular survey. So, next slide, please.
It's up to the committee, so are we okay with that to go back and forth, or did you want to? Hour and a half. And 1 hour and a half.
The end, or can we do this as a back and forth? Whatever works for everybody, I can save it. That's no problem. Just wondering what the format is.
Okay, so we will decide. So, what do we want to do this back and forth, or should we wait?
What works for you?
I'm fine with either.
Okay, nothing from the committee, so I guess we're fine.
Okay, lovely. In terms of the what they heard, was that both industry or and civilians or individuals who are buying homes?
Jamie Chippett, Deputy Minister, SNL. It depends on, there were a couple of what we heard documents. One was from industry.
Right.
Then there were results, I think, from the EngageNL survey that formed a part of government's what we heard document,
right,
if you will.
Okay, just wanted to make sure that we're getting both perspectives. Okay, thank you.
I have one quick question. Okay. Derek Bennett, Willsburg. Just wondering, so that you say in 2012 there was a review, complete review done. What was the process used in 2012 versus the process now? There was no amendments in 2012, and here we are seeing 53 recommendations that put forward.
So I don't think there's anybody on this side this morning that could speak to why from 2012. But I do know there was a consultation done. There were, I think, 18 submissions through that process. But obviously SNL is a department with lots of legislation. I can imagine you prioritize over time. But Renee, do you have a comment on that?
At that time, you know, there was a submission went out, and while there was great feedback, the quantity of the feedback was low. And for those reasons, based on priorities, it didn't come to fruition.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So next slide just speaks to a change in terminology that you'll see throughout the draft bill. It was considered to be the industry norm to refer to a broker rather than an agent. So that's changed in the interpretation section and then throughout the bill. And in particular, it's in section 2.1c. So there are changes in the bill as well with respect to licensing requirements and obviously the overall objective, which was a goal of both the departments and NLAR, was to provide more stringent requirements to register as a broker or a salesperson. So specifically, Section 7.1A allows the superintendent to set the form of the applications for a license. Section 7 would require a criminal background check. Section 12F, licensees would have to notify the superintendent of information changes. Regulations would prescribe the requirements, qualifications, and conditions for issuing licenses, and would allow the superintendent to modify license requirements. And that's Section 47. And the minister would have the ability under Section 48 to set new fees or establish new forms. So I know that through the Engage NL consultations, the response that got the highest percentage of in favor of any question in the questionnaire was the need for continuing education requirements. And so the Act in Section 5.1B would allow the superintendent the authority to prescribe continuing education requirements. Next slide, please. Thank you. So incorporation is addressed, and again, you know, a lot of these amendments are about modernizing or recognizing current practice that is more common in other jurisdictions than here. So the Act allows a salesperson or salespersons to establish and operate personal real estate corporations similar to other independent contractors in other industries. And the bill allows that in Section 10. Section 9 says a personal real estate corporation could apply for a license, and a license could be issued to such a corporation through the authorities in Section 6.1E. I guess generally speaking, the current Act speaks more to an employer-employee relationship, whereas in a fair number of the other jurisdictions, it speaks to independent contractor status. And this section of the Act, the proclamation, would be subject to changes to our IT system within ServiceNL.
Thank you. In terms of incorporation, I understand that this is you often incorporate to protect the individuals operating in the corporation, and you know it gives you different legal legal rights, legal responsibilities, but also legal protections. Will this have any impact on the consumers?
Just a reminder, if we could all introduce ourselves prior to speaking.
Got it.
Every time.
Okay.
For answer.
Okay. Michael Delaney.
Thank you, Michael.
I think, you know, ultimately, not to a great deal. I mean, I think it's, you know, a large percentage of this is really, you know, as I said, for corporations, almost for tax purposes as
right.
well. There's a, you know, really, it's allowing, you know, these individuals to change their tax setup. So I think in terms of the consumer is not going to notice the difference other than, you know, it's really going to be behind the scenes where, you know, this individual is going to have to go and register as a company and file different taxes and things like that. But
right.
it won't be obvious necessarily to the consumer the difference.
Okay. Can I go again? Allison Kaufman again. You've kind of opened up a slightly different path there. If taxes have changed, and I think corporate taxes are very, very low, which is substantially different than, say, an income tax, has anyone done any analysis on what the effect would be on government revenue?
Michael Delaney. The expected take-up of this is extremely low.
Okay.
So this is not something that really, I think the indications we, you know, we got was it could be as low as like 10, you know, there's really only maybe 10 to maybe at most 20 individuals that might look to incorporate. So this is not expected to have any material impact in terms of the tax base.
Okay. Allison Kaufman again. Just thinking that there might be some, just given that the rates are slightly different, so that'd be an interesting thing to watch. Thank you.
Jamie Chippett, Deputy Minister, SNL. So we're on the slide entitled Errors and Omissions Insurance. And this is really recognizing a standard that pretty much exists in a lot of the industry. So the new bill will require real estate brokers and salespersons to maintain errors and omissions insurance to protect professionals whose clients could claim damages as a result of that professional's negligent actions. So Section 715F is the section that gives that authority or requirement. The amount of insurance would be set in regulations. You'll hear a few times throughout the presentation that there are things that will come a little bit later in regulations in terms of the details. We do say here that $1 million in errors and omissions insurance is what we understand to be the industry standard. So on slide, next three slides actually relate in one way or another to a code of conduct. During the consultations, there was also a very high percentage who favored the development of the code of conduct. We do know that the local association, provincial association, has a code of conduct for its members, but there's no legislative requirement around that. Similarly, the national association has a code of conduct as well. So this bill would allow the superintendent in SNL to establish a code of conduct. Section reference is 5.1A. And then, as I said earlier, further details would be provided in the regulations, including the ability for the superintendent to suspend, revoke, or cancel a license for a breach of the code. And that is, in terms of the regulation-making clause, it's Section 47.
Quick question? Derek Bennett, Wolfsburg. Just a quick question there. How does this relate to other jurisdictions regarding the code of conduct and the ability of the superintendent to enforce these?
I'm going to defer to Michael or Renee, but I do know a large number of the other jurisdictions have a code. I'm going to say it may be PEI, maybe the only one that doesn't. So I'm getting nods. Yes. So every other jurisdiction, with the exception of PEI.
Thank you.
Next slide, please. So conflict of interest, obviously closely related to code of conduct, and the Act would establish restrictions on salespersons providing real estate and mortgage brokerage services. There was considerable feedback, but it was mixed on this particular question, and the bill would restrict a licensed real estate salesperson from providing both real estate services and mortgage brokerage services to the same client during a related or the same related business transaction. And that's in Section 28. And lastly, in terms of things that relate to the code, the Act would establish disclosure requirements for referrals by real estate brokers and salespersons for related services such as mortgage or inspection services. There's no such requirement today. And in particular, in second bullet here, we make reference to the fact that where there's a fee involved, then disclosure would be required under Section 20. And again, the code of conduct, which would be a separate exercise and, be developed outside of the Act itself, would provide further details on that.
Barry Patton, on all this the code of conduct, conflict of interest and whatnot, enforcement. I know you got a superintendent of the real estate, but how do you enforce real estate agents? They're all over, they're everywhere. Like how do you know? I'm reading this all sounds good. I'm just wondering how you all this stuff sounds good in theory everywhere, but it's all about enforcement. Like how does this be enforced? How do you know? How do you know they're going? You know the referrals. how do you, like, I just wondering, thinking to myself, with a real estate agent, it's very personal when you meet the buyer buying a house. The real estate agent and the person buying a house, it's a very personal relationship for a few weeks. They're dealing and they're saying, well, you go get this inspector or I'll get this one. Like, how do you know? How do you police that? I guess that's the question for all of this stuff. Or is that just an honor system? Or
Michael Delaney. So certainly, you know, I think that's the crux of the question. And I think that part of it will be answered in a couple of the slides, I think, in terms of the orders and the ability to issue fines. But I think, you know, coming back to really the specific question, I think it's first is public awareness about what the rules are. So as I said, it's one thing to have a new legislation, but if the public, you know, the actual individuals who are buying or selling aren't really aware of the rules that are, you know, that their agent or sorry, their broker or salesperson are held to account, then they're not going to know to question things. But if they are, the public is aware, then it's a lot of the things that we see through the regulatory enforcement are issues that come forward from the public. So the public will complain to Service NL, maybe that, you know, I said that raise an issue that they were aware maybe after the fact that there was some kickback on a referral, to, you know, that they didn't know that this home inspector knew this broker, and they question, you know, they question Service NL about it, and we would do an investigation and try to get to the, you know, to see if the code of conduct in terms of the disclosure was provided to the individual. And again, recognizing in some cases the disclosure was there, but it was buried in paperwork and the individual may just not have read it and understood it. But again, I think it's making sure that the public is aware around the boundaries and what's acceptable and what's not. And the other way would be through, you know, monitoring, and certainly we have the ability to inspect documents or request, we review, sales agreements and things like that that are purchase and sales agreements, because if money goes into a trust account and there's some question about it, we'd be able to see the actual agreement itself and maybe would identify issues. So there's a wide variety, but I think the key is that the public is aware about what's acceptable.
But how would you make the public aware? Is there a way, like when the real estate agent engages with a buyer, some sort of handout information sheet? These are your rights. You can do a public awareness campaign, but if the buyer does not know these are the rules that the real estate agent is supposed to operate under, you're left with, again, you're left in, most buyers probably would not know. Like, I'm just trying to get the information to the buyer. These are your rights. Like, so, you know, if they don't violate your rights, well, then it's incumbent upon you to bring it to the superintendent or whatever, right? I'm just wondering how you bridge the gap there. Like, is there any, that seems to be a gap in the...
Renee Dyer. Oftentimes in our department, you know, the public, even though we feel that the public isn't aware, you just need to a couple of instances, and then all of a sudden, certainly news travels. But there is a complaints process, so they would call into our department, they would lodge a complaint, and there would be a review. And with the stronger legislation now, there's an opportunity for fines, for enforcement, for publicizing, any type of contravention to the legislation, and that really deters others from doing so. One of the first things we're going to do is certainly educate and look at work with the real estate agents, making sure they understand the legislation and it's clear to them, and understanding what the the parameters are. If legislation is in contravention, what the fines, the administrative penalties are. So there's a lot more substance now with the new legislation that our department can provide a much stronger enforcement that previously we would have had to go to the courts to decide. So I think, you know, we're at a point in our department, we do have an investigative team that would go out and do investigations as well. But I think in working with NLAR, the association, working with the salespeople and working with the public and educating them further, and through, it's going to be a period of time, but you only need a couple of instances, and all of a sudden everybody starts to fall in line pretty quickly.
Just wondering, on the inspection basis, would they have a sheet or a questionnaire that they would follow, all being the same for those guys that are doing the home inspections part of it?
Well, you know, some of the questions that come up, Renee Dyer, sorry, some of the questions that come up is, purchasing a home is a pretty big investment. So you really rely on the home inspection to ensure that everything is up to standard. And some of the complaints that we get is that the home inspector, you know, didn't find three or four things that potentially are substantial, and they may have never would have purchased that home had they known otherwise. And, you know, through, you know, they may find out that there was a strong relationship between this home inspector and this salesperson. What will need to happen now is, under the code of conduct, is full disclosure. So if there is any relationship, any type of commission, referrals, fees that are being paid to a home inspector, or the home inspector is paying the salesperson, it will have to be disclosed in advance. Any type of conflict of interest will have to be disclosed in advance to the purchaser of the home. And what we're finding now is a lot of salespeople are providing 3 to 4 different options from a home inspection perspective. So they don't want to kind of taint the waters in any one home inspector. So they're providing, and, you know, as part of, you know, providing a better service to your customer, that you're providing 3 or 4 different home inspectors. And certainly, you know, it's based on reputation. So you certainly want to make sure that your customer is happy and that the home inspection does meet those standards.
Thank you.
Okay. Jamie Chippett, Deputy of SNL. I just add one thing to that particular question. On the code of conduct piece, the industry, the association, was very much in favor of that. So we do expect that a lot of, you know, obviously the onus at the end of the day is on the agent or the broker or the salespeople to follow the code. So I think there's a strong interest within the industry as well to be kind of upping their game with respect to certain aspects of their business. So we're on the slide entitled Recovery Fund. And this is it's a major consumer protection initiative. And the goal here is to create a real estate recovery fund to protect consumers from financial loss in cases where a broker or salesperson is convicted of an offense, has a civil judgment made against them, or declares bankruptcy. And so these would replace the current bond requirements that are in place over time. Obviously, some of those existing bonds need to, you know, live out their time before certain before you would move to the new recovery fund. The bill would create the fund. The notion is that it would be financed by industry participants and managed by ServiceNL. That's in Section 25 of the Act. And the regulations, again, would set out the details on the how. In other words, how licensees would contribute to the fund and the administration of the fund. And again, this is used in several other jurisdictions in the country. So on trust deposits, the goal here, the intent of the legislation, is to streamline the release of trust deposits where the conditions in a purchase and sales agreement have not been met. The bill would allow the deposit. It would confirm, this is really a practice, it would confirm that the deposit could be released according to the terms of the contract signed. And that's in Section 26.4. But it would also enable the superintendent to direct the disbursement of the deposit in 26.4E. And again, further details would be reflected in the regulations, and Section 47 is the regulation-making clause in the bill. So aged... Oh, question?
Okay. Yep. Allison Coffin. In terms of the trust account, oh, and there's another one. Sorry. And the recovery fund. The trust account, does that always does that exist right now when we're just putting more terms around it? I'm sorry. I'm not quite sure if I understand what's going on there. I understand what the first one is, the recovery account if stuff goes wrong from the buyer's perspective or from the realtor's perspective. But this trust account, is that established when the negotiation is happening? Can you just get a little more detail on that for me, please?
Michael Delaney. So trust accounts exist right now. So
right.
In terms of agree to purchase a home, and you put money, you give your deposit to the broker who is required to place that money in a trust account, so
right.
held in trust. And certainly the purpose of the recovery fund is to ensure that if something was to go awry, that the recovery fund would be able to make whole any issues with a trust account. But the improvements, and it was something, again, looked that industry was looking for, is that there are a lot of issues with this money gets placed into trust, and there's an agreement that's signed, but the agreement falls through due to one issue or another, and then there's a dispute over who is entitled to the money that's been held in trust. And so right now there's a considerable amount of money that is really in limbo because the broker is not willing to, you know, is unclear about who the money should be released to, and really the only mechanism is to kind of go through the courts,
right,
to have that money released. And again, the intent here is to, A, clarify that, you know, if the agreement is clear in terms of who the money should be returned to, then the broker should be returning it to that party. And if not, if there's some ambiguity around that the superintendent would have the ability to adjudicate and then direct who would receive the money.
Okay, so it's a simplification. Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you.
Jamie Chippett, Deputy of SNL. So that's a perfect segue into the next slide, which is around aged trust deposits. And so the intent of the legislation here is to establish a mechanism for disbursement of aged trust deposits without going to court. So the bill in particular would allow the superintendent to adjudicate disputes over trust deposits. So that's in Section 27. It would also enable unclaimed trust money that had been in trust for more than 2 years to be paid into the recovery fund that we talked about earlier. That's in Section 27 as well. And again, the regulations will put in the detail around the superintendent making decisions on the disputed trust deposits.
Chair recognizes MHA Bennett. Derek Bennett. With regards to the decisions made by the superintendent, is there an appeal process if the buyer or seller does not agree with it?
Deputy Minister Jamie Chippett, Deputy SNL. Any decisions of the superintendent can be appealed to the Financial Services Regulations Board. So the next couple of slides relate to the concept we talked about earlier with respect to enforcement. Obviously, any good regulatory system needs to have a good enforcement and, fines and penalties associated with it. So in terms of administrative fines and penalties, currently there were no such allowances in the Act for those. So the intent of the legislation is to establish those for minor infractions and provide authority to publish the administrative decisions. The bill would allow for these fines to be assessed by the superintendent for specific contraventions of the Act. So that would be Section 35. The maximum fine would be $10,000, as set out in 36(1)(c). And the regulations would outline the specific contraventions and the time, amount, and manner of payment of fines.
Allison Coffin, in terms of the $10,000 limit, will that be sufficient? Or is that something, I guess legislation will be reviewed on a periodic basis, so that could scale. So that $10,000 is deemed sufficient to cover off anything that might be a breaking of those rules. But is that something that should be associated with the value of the house, or is it something that should look at being scaled, or will that be taken care of as we review the legislation into the future?
Jamie Chippett, Deputy Minister of SNL. So my understanding, so first of all, these are for minor infractions.
Right, okay.
And I'll let Renee, I think, speak to some of the things that, you know, this could be as simple as reporting that the department should get that we don't get and so on. So I think it is sufficient, but yeah. In terms of the specific types of things, I'll just turn that over to Renee.
Renee Dyer. I do think it is sufficient at present. We got to walk before we run in okay. this place. And most of these would be for administrative infractions. So oftentimes, you know, we're challenged with certain real estate agents to file on time to get their licensing renewal information into us and their fees. And it can, you know, create a lot of additional work from a department perspective. So, you know, introducing an administrative fine to, you know, pay your fees and your information on time, or you will be charged an additional fee, I'm hoping that we'll certainly get a higher, you know, submission of their fees and their information. And it could be for, you know, not disclosing the appropriate information to, you know, non-disclosure of having relationships, referral fees, inappropriate conduct from a salesperson perspective. So, and there would be, depending on the, you know, the infraction would determine the type of fine. And we would certainly look for the other jurisdictions and what they've done in the past and certainly follow a similar type of approach.
Thank you.
Jamie Chippett. So we're on the slide now entitled Court-Imposed Fines. And again, the intent of the legislation is to increase fines under the Act from the current range of $1,000 to $2,000, which would strengthen the regulatory system and promote greater compliance. The bill that the committee has in front of it would increase the maximum fine for individuals or incorporated bodies to $50,000, where the person is found guilty of an offense for contravention of the Act, and that's laid out in Section 45.
Sarah Studley, MHA, on Section 45.3, it talks about the fact that if an offense continues over more than one day, they're liable to be convicted for a separate offense. So I guess if it goes over 3 days, they get convicted potentially three times and get three fines. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on how that would work and what an example of something, a conviction would be where something continues over more than one day.
Sorry, what section were you referring to?
45.3.
Okay, just to make sure that... Renee Dyer. What I would say is that, you know, any offense over a period of time, we would certainly look at every instance and judge accordingly. So if someone's fees weren't paid, you know, for the third day in, we wouldn't look at it as three different infractions. We would look at it as one. Sure. So it really is dependent on the circumstances and but we wouldn't certainly look at three different offenses just because it was over a three-day period.
Mm-hmm. Michael Delaney, and I think that, you know, this relates to the, I guess, more so to the offenses than the administrative issue. So this is where there's clearly being contravention of the legislation, and really it's recognizing that, so the prior, I guess the current legislation recognizes first-time offenses versus second-time offenses. That wasn't, I guess that's been changed in terms of the bill that's been presented to committee. But still the concept of if there's been multiple infractions, that we don't want the legislation, I guess, to limit that you can only seek an offense for that. You know, if they're repeating the same offense over and over again, and I guess it refers to one day, but I guess you can consider, you know, if there's been non-compliance and maybe money being removed from trust accounts or something significant, and then, you know, they've even been warned by the superintendent, or, and then they repeat the issue, you know, two, three, you know, maybe a week later, but you can consider 2-3 months later, that there's the ability to recognize that there's actually been multiple breaches of the legislation, so, and that they can each then each infraction can be brought forward to the court as a separate offense, and again the you know what the court can then consider that when issuing any fines. So.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Jamie Chippett. So this speaks to enforcement again, and also to some of the additional regulatory authority that the department would be given. So the goal here is to allow the superintendent to issue orders to correct the situation deemed not in the best interest of the consumer. So this speaks, I think, to MHA Patton's question earlier as well. The bill would allow the superintendent to issue an order to suspend or cancel a license, impose additional conditions on a license, pay a fine of up to $10,000 or some other order prescribed in regulations. That's laid out in Section 36. And as we talked about earlier, appeals to any of the superintendent's decisions could be made to the Financial Services Appeal Board. So this is our last slide, and it's on housekeeping and proclamation. The bill provides for the appointment of a superintendent and deputy superintendent by the minister rather than lieutenant governor and council. Just to talk a little bit to the rationale related to that, these positions are public service positions that are hired through the merit-based competition process of the Public Service Commission. So really they would happen through the normal competition process and come up through the deputy and the minister in the department. There have been plain language amendments throughout the Act and a reorganization and modernization generally throughout the Act. Just in terms of readability and organization. At present, it indicates that the bill would come, the law would come into effect on January 1st, 2020, except for sections dealing with the Recovery Fund and personal real estate corporations, which would be proclaimed once the appropriate administrative measures are in place. That's in Section 54.
Have any questions? MHA Studley? Sarah Studley. When I was speaking with my real estate colleagues about this bill, they seemed very excited, so that's good, because I'm not a real estate expert. But there's one area where they understand that legislation's changing that I didn't see and I couldn't pick out in the legislation. I was wondering if you could, I guess, speak about how this is protecting or informing consumers and the general public if a real estate agent is both the seller, representing the seller and the buyer. Is that covered in the legislation? I guess how so? What changes are being put in place when the same person is both selling the home and representing the seller and the buyer?
Michael Delaney. So dual agency. It is, in terms of the consultations, that was one of the areas where there was a little bit, I guess there wasn't a clear direction, a consensus in terms of whether, for example, to restrict dual agency. So British Columbia is the only province that actually prohibits dual agency, I believe, in certain circumstances. I'm not sure even in all circumstances. But that was certainly something that was considered. But, I mean, certainly when you think about the rural impact of that, there's concerns in terms of, you know, you have some smaller regions around the province where there may only be one broker, and then forcing individuals to have to find someone else, one of the parties to find someone else, there's concerns with that side of it. So the approach that's been taken will be to deal with that more through the code of conduct and the disclosure requirements, just to make sure. And this works well in other jurisdictions. I used to live in Nova Scotia, and I remember purchasing a home there, and there was, you know, these disclosure requirements around the dual agency, just to make sure that you're aware that the broker is working for both parties or the salesperson is working for both parties. So we'll certainly be leveraging, you know, the disclosure requirements in other jurisdictions. But, you know, I think there's the there hasn't been a lot of public, it's identified as a potential conflict of interest, but we haven't seen, I guess I would speak for the department, we haven't seen a lot of issues come forward to the department around this. I think it's, you know, the industry is accustomed to dealing with this, and really what we want to do is make sure that the rules, the code of conduct, are clear for everybody in industry, so there is kind of a standard approach in terms of dealing with this.
Just a follow-up question then. So I guess in terms of the disclosure and the code of conduct, if I was selling my house and my real estate agent was also dealing with the buyer, how would I know, I guess I probably would see the same email address on my emails, but in terms of the disclosure, I guess, how would that pragmatically look like for the buyer or the seller?
So I think some of it will have to be kind of worked out in specifics, but you can certainly see that there would documentation to some extent provided to the individual, or certainly that they would be it would be verbally explained as well to the individual that okay, I'm representing the other party in this, and explaining how that can potentially create a conflict and assure the buyer that or the seller that the salesperson can assure them that they can deal with that and treat both parties separately. In the end of the day, the individual would then have the choice to say, no, I'd rather deal with someone else. Right? I think as long as they're aware, and certainly they could, part of it may be if they wanted to call into the department to get some information from the superintendent of real estate around what that means and what the potential risks are, you can envision that as part of the solution as well.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Derek Bennett, first of all, I just want to commend the department for the great job in the public engagement part of it, getting the feedback from the Realtor Association and all the public consultations, and through Engage and L. Through the process, was there any other issues of significance identified by either of the groups that's not being addressed now in the legislation that would address further concerns?
Jamie Chippett. I don't think so. I think everything's been addressed in one way or another. I think obviously there are some things, the details will come later when you do the regulations. The things that got high percentages of feedback in the survey were the things like clarity around trust deposits, the continuing education piece, code of conduct in particular was a high one as well. So anything that came up multiple times or what have you that, we would gauge to be, either an issue raised by the public on a frequent basis or the realtors on a frequent basis, I think have been addressed.
Good. Thank you.
Sorry for coming. Alison Coffin. I like this. I see what the industry has done around protecting consumers, which is very, very important. I see what's been done around protecting the industry and establishing a high standard within that industry, and that's very reassuring as well. One of the quotes is, I don't want a criminal in my home. Good. I'm very happy to hear that. Something that I'll look forward to seeing is how they roll out the professional development training, and what standards that comes from, where that belongs, and things like that. That'll be a very interesting piece about. But I think that will strengthen the industry as well. One piece that might be an issue. I didn't see anywhere in your presentation, but does this new legislation mean that everyone buying a home must go through a realtor, someone certified under this? Or, because I know people can buy houses at your own peril, people can buy houses without going through a real estate agent. I thought I saw one little piece there where someone doesn't have to be registered or doesn't fall under it, but I think that was a legal person. So is that still possible under this legislation, or does everyone have to get funneled through this piece?
Jamie Chippett, the existing arrangements would still apply.
Okay, yeah. Good. All right, that's reasonable. And Alison Coffin again, second time. Competition in an industry is very important as well. This reinforces standards around professional conduct and relationships in terms of money and all of those things and relationship with government. Does it dampen the competitive spirit within the industry? That's a concern as well.
Michael Delaney. I don't think it's not changing. So I guess one of the considerations or one of the potential models would be, for example, like co-regulation with the association, or providing the association more of a, making them the responsible for the enforcement and the regulation, and when I say the Association of Realtors, NLR, and I think they had indicated, and they certainly indicated to the department, and they indicated in their documentation that they're at this time they're not interested in a co-regulation type approach, that they are happy enough to, I guess, to be the association and allow the legislation and the superintendent to be responsible for enforcement. So part of that, I guess, to go back to your question, is that so not all of, you know, the brokers and salespeople are part of NLAR. There are those, a small, relatively small percentage who are not. And this, again, is not looking to require any of those individuals to join up with the association or you know, change, I guess, the current arrangements that are in place. You know, I think when you move towards some of the enhancements around, you know, certainly, I guess, the continuing professional development code of conduct and those types of things, you know, that's why, I guess, you know, the department will then be responsible for rolling that out and making sure that it is accessible. For example, training, you know, if there's minimum professional development requirements, that it's, you know, that it's accessible to brokers and salespeople in all regions of the province, and not you know, so again, you can envision, you know, not maybe having in person, but there's more online availability than allowing that. So it's, again, not to prohibit any individual from you know, becoming a professional. I think there will be, you know, and again, something the industry is looking for, there will be enhanced standards, and certainly there is a licensing requirement now and an examination in terms of becoming a salesperson. So, again, not looking to necessarily open the you know, up to everyone, but allowing those who have the qualifications to operate a business.
Okay. Good. I think you've answered that, Alison Coffin. I think you've answered that quite reasonably. What I was worried about was there would be undue barriers to entry to the industry, but that doesn't seem to be the case. There are higher standards, but as long as you can meet those standards, you can get in. So, yeah, that's quite reasonable. Thank you.
Just a question in the salesperson, the new person going in getting some help from another salesperson, is that actually in the legislation? Because I don't know how someone that's already, that was in this when I was reading this information before, don't know how that person that's already there is going to help someone else. Sometimes that doesn't happen as easily as you would think, you know, from being a former salesperson.
Jamie Chippett. Certainly discussion of that throughout the process. And again, when you think about the conversation we had about, you know, do you eliminate, for example, the notion of dual agency, or some concern when you put a rural lens on things that that experienced person in a given area might not even be in existence. I think the association was certainly, you know, talking about the value of that, but concerned about the limitations in some areas of the province. So I think you'd see that mentorship happening in, obviously, you know, the different organizations between more senior salespeople and newer people, but there's no requirement in the legislation for it.
Any further speakers? Okay. And you guys are all good? Okay, on that note, I guess we can recess. So 10:45 for our next group. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're ready to get started. Good morning, everyone, and certainly thanks for coming. The procedure today will be as follows. The presenter will have an hour and a half to speak, including time for answering questions from the committee. And members will have 10 minutes to speak and may also do so often as they wish. However, last time we kind of had open dialogue the way through, so if that's okay, we can certainly proceed the way we did last time. But we ask that you identify yourself each time you speak for the benefit of Hansard and the Broadcast Center. And before we start now, I'll ask members to introduce themselves. We'll start with the committee.
Alison Coffin, MHA, St. John's East Kitivitte.
Derek Bennett, MHA, Lewisburg-Twillingate.
Sarah Studley, MHA, Mount Sio.
Lyle O'Driscoll, MHA, Fairland District.
Barry Patton, MHA, Conception Bay South.
Okay. And I'm, Bill Sterling. I'm CEO of the Newfoundland Labrador Association of Realtors. And I'm Ed Hollett, Manager of Communications and Member Engagement.
Okay, and I'm Pam Parsons, Chair of the Committee and MHA for Harbor Grace, Port of Grave. And now we will get started.
Okay, it's Bill Sterling. I've just got some opening comments, I guess, to begin with, and then ready to answer whatever questions the committee may have. And before I begin, I'd just like to start by offering my congratulations to anybody who's been elected for the first time, and for those of you coming back, congratulations on your re-election. We were out during the recess looking at the previous roles, and I'm reminded my own father was a member of this honorable house back in 1979, and for a period actually sat in this seat, although it was up on the upstairs at the time. So congratulations, and it's an honorable profession, and I look forward to seeing you serve the people well. So good morning. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. The Newfoundland Labrador Association of Realtors represents 650 real estate licensees in the province, and we're pleased to be here to talk about the new legislation. Modernization and renewal of our governance system for the real estate industry in this province has been an advocacy priority for our association for many, many years. And as you know, the current legislation, the old legislation, dates back to the mid-1960s when this building was a brand new building. We are an industry association representing most licensees, but not all licensees. So we provide supports to our members, educational programs, services for our members across the province. We are an industry association, not unlike Hospitality Newfoundland is the Tourism Industry Association, and CME would be the Manufacturing Industry Association. Oftentimes people in the public confuse us with the regulator and the role that we play in ethics enforcement, but we are not a regulator, obviously, as you would be aware. So we operate the only multiple listing service in the province. We offer technology products, insurance products and services, educational programs for our members. We also require that our members abide by the Realtor Code of Ethics, the Standards of Business Practice, and with our relationship with Service Newfoundland, with the regulator, we deliver the pre-license training programs for people who want to write the salesperson license or the broker's license. We deliver that on behalf of Service Newfoundland. And we coordinate the exams with the College of North Atlantic for that. So when the department announced the review of the Real Estate Trading Act in 2017, we very quickly mobilized. We had done a lot of work over the years on our recommendations and our thoughts on where the legislation needed to go, but we also wanted to hear from members. We wanted to hear from consumers. So we went on the road and we did 16 meetings in 8 locations around the province in January and February of 2018. So we were in St. John's and Bay Roberts, Clarenville, Grand Falls, Cornerbrook, Goose Bay, Lab City. We did public meetings and we did meetings with our members. So out of that, we heard from a couple hundred people, and from that we compiled 2 reports, which was shared with the committee prior to this, and was shared with the department. One report was a compilation of what we heard from our public engagement, and then there was a series of recommendations in the second report. And what we heard when we were on the road clearly was a call for modern regulation. The real estate industry has evolved in the digital economy in ways that we could never have foreseen. And trying to manage the industry with a set of rules that were written in 1964 just don't work. And so, we heard a loud call, clear for better enforcement tools for the regulator, for more modern education, for a variety of improvements. And so we put all of that in our recommendations, in our 53 recommendations. And we are, we worked closely, I guess, with the department as part of that consultation process. They had representation at a number of our meetings. And so we're thrilled to see that a lot of our recommendations have have made it into the legislation. You know, we're particularly pleased to see a streamlined process for dealing with disputes over deposits on transactions that don't close. The establishment of a recovery fund, I think, goes a long way in terms of protecting not only our members and licensees, but also consumers from situations where right now the protections are not there in the legislation. We are, I think, the only jurisdiction currently in the country that does not have a requirement for continued professional development for anybody who has a real estate license. We have a professional development program, a requirement for our members. It's great to see a requirement for professional development for all licensees in the province. The addition of a code of conduct and the requirement for certificates of conduct for all licensees is something that we were recommending, and we're glad to see it. We're glad to see the ability for licensees to self-incorporate. For the most part, real estate agents, salespeople are, while they're licensed under a broker, they work for a company. For all intents and purposes, they are self-employed independent contractors. In the eyes of the law, in the eyes of Revenue Canada and Workers' Comp, they are self-employed individuals. But yet they can't take advantage of any of the benefits of being able to incorporate. So we're glad to see that is in the new legislation. I think what's really important is the range of enforcement tools that the superintendent will have to deal with matters. Right now, the only tool that the superintendent has is to cancel somebody's license. So we often see, for example, somebody might be a week late in filing a report or renewing their bond, and as a result, their license is canceled. That means they have no livelihood, they have no ability to generate income, they're not allowed to talk to their clients about their listings. Everything comes to a grinding halt simply because of an error in filling out a form or renewing a bond. The new legislation gives the superintendent the ability to charge a fee or a fine or impose a less severe penalty for something that's really a minor administrative thing. So we're glad to see that. And we're really pleased to see the maximum fines being increased beyond the current level. That's the single largest deterrent for behavior. Is the financial deterrent. So we're pleased to see that. So just in conclusion, I guess we're pleased to see that the regulators listen to consumers across the province. They've listened to members of our industry, and we see that the new legislation looks across the country at where the best practices are and adopts a lot of the best practices from that we see in other jurisdictions, and. We're glad to see the department moving ahead with it. So we'd like to thank the minister for her efforts and her officials for their efforts and their cooperation with us. And with that, if there's any questions, we're pleased to take them.
Okay. Any questions for our committee? MHA Studley. Hi, Sarah Studley. One of the issues you raised, I think rightfully so, in your book here, you call it Modernization and Clarity in the Information Age under Digital Revolution. And you go through that in the first and second volumes of your recommendations. When I guess, read this again and now think back through the legislation that we're reviewing, I'm not sure that we're covering this. I'm just wondering, I guess, from your perspective, is that a big deal? Are there gaps still in terms of legislation around aggregator sites pulling information from your MLS system? Do you see any big gaps there immediately?
Short answer is no. Some of those kinds of issues are, when you dig into them, are not really issues that can be governed through a broad piece of legislation. It's more around data protection and intellectual property protection that we have to as the operator of an MLS database with 300,000 listings in there. You know, that's part of our responsibility is to protect that data, you know, on behalf of consumers. There is an issue that we see where consumers aren't necessarily aware when they're looking at a website whether or not that is a website of somebody who is licensed to trade real estate in this province and or somebody who is not. And there are services out there that are available to consumers, and it's not always clear that you're looking at something that is a licensed website. I think there's an education program that we can do around that, a consumer education program to create awareness. And again, that's not something that we would see as being legislated. That's more about a, you know, a consumer awareness campaign.
Okay. Are you aware, just by chance, of any other jurisdictions doing any legislation around, I guess, modernizing the real estate sector?
Yeah, not particularly. Okay. Again, it's part of the challenge that we had in with the old rules, and I'll use Facebook as an example, right? Our rules were written in a time when the only way you knew a property was for sale is if you saw a sign on the lawn or you saw an ad, a printed ad in the newspaper. And there was very specific rules around how what that ad had to contain. But, you know, if you move into today's world, where everything is online and consumers know so much about a neighborhood or so much about a property long before they ever call a real estate agent, it's hard for us to enforce advertising rules and standards that were written for a print era in a digital world. So how do we, because advertising is advertising, whether it's on Facebook or on the internet, on a website, or it's in an ad. We're trying to apply the same rules to the same advertising. And so, for example, for our members, we have a rule that says you cannot advertise a property until it has an MLS number, which means it's in our database, which means everybody who's a member of ours has access to the information. And that's about fairness of competition. Is an Instagram post an ad, you know? I mean, that's something that we struggle with all the time, is how far do we go in policing all these online points of presence. So the wording in the old, and it's a lengthy answer, I know, but the wording in the old act couldn't conceive of those kinds of applications, right? So that's the kind of thing we're trying to move towards.
Okay, thank you. Good. Okay, MHA Patton.
Thank you, Barry Patton. Just a couple of questions. When you've done your consultations, I know a lot of things in legislation when service and I was just in previously, like code of conduct, and is one big one, I guess. Did all the agents agree? Like, I know this is, seems like both parties are happy with this legislation, but yeah, it's bringing new rules in place for realtors. Like, did they all agree? Like, when you had your consultations, or is the industry very happy about this legislation? Because it's going to create a lot of good in this, for the buyer and for the public, but it's going to put an old new layer for your association and your realtors. And I know it's more about transparency and accountability too, but are they all, I guess generally, are they all welcoming this change to legislation and this increase in penalties, obviously, as well?
Yeah, Bill Sterling. Short answer, yes, absolutely. The more we can do to improve professionalism in this industry, the better off our members are served and the better off consumers are served. You know, like every profession out there, I guess, our industry is a microcosm of society. And, you know, there are people who are licensed who are the utmost professionals. And, you know, and at the other end of the scale, there's a continuum of that goes the opposite direction. Our members are strongly in support of improved enforcement, strongly in favor of improved educational standards, making it harder to get into the industry. And I don't mean harder in terms of more difficult financially or whatever, but making it making the height bar, the level of professionalism higher, you've got to clear a higher height bar to be licensed and maintain your license than we currently have. And most people in the industry absolutely support that kind of improvement in our regulation.
In the code of conduct as well, I asked this question earlier, so I just let me hear side too, was notifying, educating the buyer of their rights, this disclosure or whatever form, hand out certain thing you'd have to sign to acknowledge that the buyer has rights, outside of what realty was many years ago. You say sign on a lawn, or you knew this person that was in the real estate. So as an association, is this something that I'm curious about the policing part of it, actually? These it's all good, and every piece of legislation comes to this place. There's always an enforcement or a follow-up or accountability piece. To any piece of legislation, that's as good as any legislation is. So I know I got the side from the service and with the superintendent, but from your end of it, it's a role for both sides to play in keeping everyone above board. And what you just said, I agree with you. You're raising the bar, level of professionalism. You can't go wrong. I mean, it helps any industry, any group. But from that end of it, what is your, do you have any plans in place for that part?
Well, it's interesting. Bill Sterling again. The law has evolved. Consumer law has evolved over the years. What we refer to as agency law has evolved since the time of our legislation. So following through the lead of the Canadian Real Estate Association, we've actually, our members have been operating using agency and agency representation for many, many years. So when you list your house with an agent, they will have a discussion with you about your rights as their client and what their responsibilities are, what their fiduciary responsibilities are, and how they represent you and represent your interests, and the level of confidentiality in that. Similarly, when you're a buyer and you're working with an agent, there will be a discussion around representation. And I know we had some questions this morning. I was listening to the live stream about dual agency, and we can probably have a chat about that after. So we have operated, very clearly, and within our code of conduct, our members know very well their responsibilities as a buyer's agent or a seller's agent, or if they're in that dual agency kind of representation, how they have to protect both sides. We've been operating that way for many, many years. It's in our code of conduct. It's in our realtor code, our standards of business practice. The difference, though, with the legislation is that our rules, our code of conduct apply to our members. And we forget oftentimes that not everybody who is licensed is a member of ours. We're not like the College of Physicians where everybody is a member, right? We are not the regulator. So there are members or there are licensees that are not captured by that. So they don't have the same tools to guide them. And I brought along a couple of examples I can share with the clerk of our agency disclosure forms and the information that is required to be disclosed to clients. We've done a lot of work, and again, through the Canadian Real Estate Association, we use the same agency kind of, buyer, seller, dual agency language right across the country, right? So what's nice about the legislation is that will bring that same level of responsibility to everybody who's licensed.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you say, so those groups, I remember, because I was on the committee the last go-around, I remember this conversation. Yeah. Wouldn't it be important, or wouldn't it be worth considering having everybody make it mandatory to be part of this association? It's not unlike in many other groups in the province. And then you keeps the regulations tight, and it protects the consumer, which is, again, most important thing what we try to protect. You're trying to protect everyone's interests. So if you got this group that are not really all into any association rules, so... they're separate entities, so it brings,
Yeah, and that's the model in New Brunswick. In New Brunswick, they actually have two pieces of legislation. They have the equivalent of the Trading Act, but they also have the New Brunswick Real Estate Association Act. And it requires that everybody who is licensed be a member of the association. And then the association takes on a co-regulator kind of role, and particularly around education and realtor code enforcement. We had some discussion with that or about that when we were putting together our recommendations. And our board of directors and our membership felt that membership should be an option. It should be a choice. Members join us because we have a value proposition and we offer services that are, that help support them in their career. So we felt at this point that we wouldn't, you know, we can have a discussion with the regulator about that sort of mandatory membership. But at this point, we weren't comfortable in recommending that because it fundamentally changes the nature of our association. As an industry association, we want members to be members of ours because they choose to be, because there's a value proposition and we provide services and they're engaged in us. If everybody is a member because they have to be, that changes the perspective, changes the language, changes the interaction we have with our membership as well. And we weren't prepared to go there right yet. Now, whether we get there 5 years from now, you know, it could be an option. You know, we already have a mandatory education program that we deliver online throughout the province. So we've got members in Lab City, we've got members in Goose Bay who do our online education program. You know, we'd be interested in having a discussion with the department about having our educational offering qualify as part of the required professional development, or we could offer, you know, training to non-licensees, and that might achieve the same thing. If licensees who are not members of ours have to do our education program, have to use our E&O insurance, they may choose to join us, but then it's them choosing as opposed to us dictating. And I think that was the same answer I gave you last time.
Can I jump in? Mm-hmm. Allison Coffin, education. I'm always interested in education. So how the program is working right now, like I know very little about the licensing part. I know mm-hmm. that you're licensed with the province.
Yep.
And your programming, I guess you're licensed with the province, so you have to write a standardized test, and that yep. standardized test is, of course, regulated by the province. Does that sit under AESL? Do you know?
No, it doesn't. It's a curriculum that was developed through Service Newfoundland. All of the regulators across the country collaborated, so it's a sort of a common curriculum right across the country for mm-hmm. all pre-license training in terms of the basic fundamentals of real estate, we call it. Other jurisdictions have other courses you also have to do to get a license. Ours is probably the easiest place in the country to get your license. So we deliver that training. It costs $1,500 plus HST. We send you a kit. We send you the books. When you're ready, you let us know, and you can write the exam at the College of North Atlantic in a number of locations around the province. It's an old way of delivering educational materials. We would like to see that all delivered online, and I think, you know, that's something that we will move forward with the department, as you know, once we get through the rollout of the legislation. I think that's one way that they're interested in modernizing education delivery. So there's two courses. There's a salesperson's course and there's a broker's course. So you sign up with us. We send you the package of information. When you're ready, you write the exam. Then you go talk to a broker about getting licensed. So.
Okay. Just wondering about the mechanisms for like who establishes the program. So you are the conduit. If I wanted to be a real estate agent tomorrow, I needed to come to you, and you would set me up in the program. But I don't have to be a member of yours.
No, that's right.
Okay. And then if I pass my exams and everything works well and I get my license, I could become a member, or I can operate independently.
Yep.
Okay, that's quite reasonable. And the curriculum now, like, there's going to be a fair bit of work involved with putting all of your materials online. Well, you can put a PDF on and say good luck.
Yeah.
But it's a different beast to develop a course which is being offered online compared to the materials are online and good luck to you. Your exam is in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So how do you envision that? Like, are you thinking about making it a course online or kind of similar to what you get right now of here's your materials and good luck, sir?
Well, taking the existing stuff and making that available so that we don't have to print off
you know,
a binder this big and put it in the mail,
right?
Is one way of at least getting moving in the right direction.
Right.
But, you know, again, there are best practices in other jurisdictions across the country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have our own learning management system, our own platform that our members do training on. We could make it available, certainly through that, through a series of modules or whatever. We had made some recommendations around there being sort of an introductory course of here's what you're getting yourself into in the real estate industry. And then do a second course that's more sort of the fundamentals of what you need to know. One of the challenges that we've seen in our industry in the last, going back many years now, there's a lot of people who look at our industry as a career choice, as a career opportunity. You know, they think they're going to make a lot of money real quick, it's not real expensive to get your license. It's not a real high height bar in terms of educational requirements. So they get their license, and then they realize that, I might not make any money in my first year. And in their second year, they might make two or three sales, right? And so we get a lot of churn. We get a lot of people come into the business for a year or two. It's not the panacea they think it's going to be, and they get out again. And one of the things that our members have said loud and clear during our consultations was maybe we should weed those people out before they actually make the commitment to join the industry. Because once you're in, you've kind of invested all of that time and money and you're, you owe it to yourself to at least give it a try. But if we had an introductory course that might be $500 or $600 as opposed to $1,500, where at the end of that they might realize just what they're getting themselves into, might eliminate some of that churn, might eliminate people who get into the business and really it's not the right career for them, right?
Yeah. Allison, again, I totally understand that. I've seen so many people take courses and go, this is not what I am supposed to do. Part of that is life, but it's also good because I can see why you want to do that introduction of this is what your life is going to be like.
Yep.
You want to help people make better life choices, which is excellent. In terms of numbers, how many members do you have? How many realtors are there? So I guess members. Your realtors in total, members who are your association, and give me some sense of how many you see running through in the course of a year.
Just a little bit of trademark protection.
Sure.
Realtor is actually a trademark of the Canadian Real Estate Association. So anybody who is a member of ours or the Canadian Real Estate Association is actually a realtor. They're only ones allowed to use that term.
Okay.
However, just like Escalator and Kleenex, it's kind of become a little bit... of a catch-all kind of phrase. So there are, there's probably, I haven't looked at the numbers this week, but there's probably close on 700 licensees in the province, and we have about 650 of those as members of ours. There's really only one significant brokerage in the province that's not a member of ours, and that's a company in Labrador City. Most of the brokerages around that are doing residential real estate would be members of ours because they want to participate in the MLS system. Most of the brokers that are not members of ours would be some of the larger commercial companies who don't need our services. And a few restricted or a few people that are doing construction new home sales, so they might do a subdivision, sell the properties directly to consumers, so they don't need our services. But we've got about 650 members, and there are probably close to 700 licensees in the province.
Okay,
Interesting. Thank you.
Any further questions?
When it comes to the MLS numbers, that's going to help you with the legislation in regards to advertising on Facebook compared to the other avenues that you have?
No, there's nothing specifically in the legislation that would apply to our MLS system. I think it's, you know, I mean, our recommendations around that were more, as I was saying earlier, about clarifying the rules around advertising, as opposed to anything that would regulate our MLS system.
Okay, MHA Studley. Sarah Studley, in your recommendations, again, you talked about dual agency, and you mentioned that already. And so you mentioned that this definition needs to be clarified so that it mirrors the rest of the country and refers to one individual, not everyone in the brokerage.
Yeah.
I know that dual agency is not a definition in the legislation. I'm just wondering if that's been handled, and or are your concerns there handled, or are there still any outstanding?
Yeah, so Bill Sterling, a lot of that detail I think will be in the regulations, which are still yet to be developed, and in the code of conduct that comes out of that. And, you know, we have our definitions of agency. What we're referring to specifically in that recommendation, under our current act, the brokerage, and, you know, and a broker might have 70 salespeople. The broker is the agent under our current legislation. So that means that, you know, if I have my house listed with ABC Company, and they got 70 agents. I might have it listed with one particular agent, but everybody in that office would be considered a dual agent under our current legislation because the broker is the agent. The rest of the country doesn't see it that way. So because, for the most part, agents are self-employed independent contractors, the rest of the country views dual agency as attached to that individual. So that one individual representing both sides, as opposed to two people in the same office, right?
So Sarah Studley, I should have asked this, I guess, when we had the staff in this morning, but do you know if that's, I guess, covered in the new proposed legislation, I guess, changing the definition, or will it still be two salespeople within the same brokerage? Will they still be considered?
Well, the legislation itself is pretty well silent on agency. It doesn't refer to it at all. I think I think that will be in the regulations and in the code of conduct, because the key with dual agency is making sure the consumers are fully aware, right? So the code of conduct and the regulations, I would expect, would be where you would see the requirements around disclosure of those kinds of relationships. So we haven't seen the regulations yet. I don't know where the department is in terms of drafting those. We haven't been a part of that. So,
thank you. No further questions. Anything else that you'd like to add? Or?
I don't think so. I know I was listening to the stream this morning, and MHA Coffin, you were asking questions around how the professional development could roll out. We're curious about that as well. I would like to see us working closely with the department. We do have a learning management platform that our members use. We have professional development materials that our members have to do on a regular basis. And that's not sales training. That's not how to do an open house. That's things like, you know, economic forecasting, legal issues, how to better protect your client, those sorts of things. So it's more about truly professional development than you know, how to make more money. We see that as the broker's role, right? We'd like to, you know, continue the kind of partnership that we have now around the pre-license training. We'd like to see that as well with the professional development program for licensees as well. Excuse me. But I don't think there's anything else we'd want to add. Thank you again for the opportunity. And if there is anything else that we can provide in terms of clarity or more information, just let us know and we'll make it available.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To our committee, of course, and to you guys. Okay. On that note, I guess we will conclude. Okay. Thank you.